This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guests today are John Mersheimer, who is the R. Wendell Harrison Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago, and Steve Walt, who is the Robert and Renee Belfer Professor of International Affairs at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School. They have just written The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. John, Steve, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be back, Harry.
Nice to be here.
Help us understand the intellectual origins of this book. You're both IR specialists. The emphasis here is on domestic politics and how it influences U.S. foreign policy.
Well, basically, in the wake of 9/11, almost all scholars of international relations began to think about the Middle East and U.S. policy in the Middle East and what went wrong. And Steve and I were talking about that matter in the spring of 2002, and we pointed out to each other that there's this phenomenon called the Israel Lobby that has a significant influence on our policy that nobody talks about or writes about. And we, at that point in time, decided we would try and do something. And then through a variety of circumstances, we ended up being commissioned by the Atlantic Monthly in the fall of 2002 to write an article. And from that point forward, began to do serious research and serious writing. And finally, in March 2006, an article came out in the London Review of Books, and that sort of exploded all across the globe and brought a great deal of notoriety to the subject and to us. And then after we wrote the article, we decided to write the book, which was then published this month here in the United States and will be published in a number of European countries and Asian countries later in the year.
I'd just say a couple of comments. I had actually done some work on the Middle East. My dissertation, which was written here at Berkeley, looked at the Middle East in some detail from an international relations perspective. There's a section of that book that actually deals with the domestic politics of alliances, including the domestic politics of the U.S. commitment to Israel. So I'd worked on this problem a little bit in the past. John and I are both regarded as realists, as people who think that, for the most part, states calculate the national interest rather carefully, and that international politics is sort of a competitive business where if you don't calculate your interests carefully, you're going to get into a lot of trouble. Mm-hmm. And a number of people have pointed out this book and the earlier article are somewhat contrary to the intellectual vision that we'd put forward. And I think the obvious answer is this is an exception to sort of standard realist behavior. And our argument in the book and elsewhere is that when domestic politics intrudes too heavily into a state's calculations and into the making of foreign policy, there's some considerable danger. You'll end up doing things that are not in your national interest. And of course, one of the main themes of the book is that's what's happened with respect to U.S.-Israeli relations over time.
As I read your book and prepared for this interview, I whipped out my Federalist number 10, which I'd like to quote right now from, because Madison writes, by a faction, I understand a number of citizens, whether amounting to a majority or minority of the whole, who are united and actuated by some common impulse of passion or of interest, adverse to the rights of other citizens or to the permanent and aggregate interests of the community. And he goes on to say in there that to secure the public good and private rights against the danger of such a faction, and at the same time to preserve the spirit and the form of popular government, is then the great object to which our inquiries are directed. So in a way, that's what you're up to here too, right? I mean, in the sense, the lobby that you're talking about is a faction.
We actually referred to Federalist 10 in the book and say that interest groups and the interplay of what Madison called factions has been woven into the way American politics works since the founding of the Republic. There's nothing unusual about what the groups in the Israel lobby are doing. We often say to each other and to people in public, you know, its activities, for the most part, are as American as apple pie. They're not illegitimate. They're just the way American politics works. But as Madison is hinting there, sometimes when a particular group or faction or interest group is too powerful, and if it's advocating things that are not in the overall interest of the country, it can be harmful to society, not because it's trying to be, but just because it's pushing things that aren't good for the country as a whole.
Yeah, and just to pick up on Steve's point, I think if you look at the National Rifle Association, we would argue that the policies that it pushes quite successfully are not in the American national interest either, for the sorts of reasons that Madison was laying out. And one could make the same argument about the farm lobby and the Cuban lobby. So when we say that the Israel lobby exists, number one, and number two, is pushing policies that are not good for the United States, we're not saying that there's anything peculiar about the Israel lobby. There are many other lobbies or interest groups like the Israel lobby, and we believe in some of those cases, not all of them, that they push policies that are not good for the overall interest of the United States. And by the way, it is possible that in the case of the Israel lobby, that if it pushed a different set of policies, this is one of Steve's favorite themes, if it pushed a different set of policies, those policies would be good for the United States, and we and Israel would be much better off as a result.
But what is distinctive here and what we're talking about, I don't believe that Madison was talking about foreign policy. He was really talking about domestic policy. And the example of the National Rifle Association, it's a domestic lobby. They don't have a foreign policy. So that makes this area, it seems to, some of the characteristics are different from the case of the NRA.
Farm lobbies, put it different. Lots of industries, you know, will push for protectionist legislation because they don't want to compete against foreign competition. So they make it hard to have free trade agreements because they want to get special protection from Congress or from the executive branch. Now, that's a foreign policy issue, and anybody who's worked on trade policy understands that domestic politics matters greatly. If they're successful, of course, they get protection. All Americans end up paying more for those goods, so it's not in the overall interest of the country to protect an industry that can't compete. But it happens all the time, and that's a foreign policy issue. I don't think there's really much of a distinction between a lobby that works to try and shape domestic politics and a lobby that works to try and influence foreign policy.
But to buttress Harry's point just a bit here, when Madison was writing, the United States was very much a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant country. And all the hyphenated Americans, so to speak, had not come to the United States at that point. And it was throughout the course of the 19th century that huge waves of country of immigrants from countries like Ireland and Germany and later the Pale of Settlement and Poland and Italy began to come to the country, that you began to get these ethnic lobbies. And of course, we have the problem or that situation today. And it's not restricted to American Jews. It would include Armenians. It would include Cuban Americans. And we see that Indian Americans are now becoming very active in pushing American foreign policy in ways that they believe are good for India and for the United States as well.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about is a theme that emerges throughout your book is the way the policies and some of these institutions, in a way, have been frozen in time or at least evolved over time in ways that were negative consequences. And a lot of the images and descriptions used about the relationship, which we'll talk about in a minute, you know, go back to an earlier period. And so let's talk a little about that, because at one point Israel was a strategic asset, but that was in the Cold War, and the Cold War ended in 1989. Israel itself has changed a lot, you know, in this period. And as you demonstrate, as when we talk about the lobby has changed over time. So talk a little about that, because it's very important, because what you're addressing a problem where the institutions you're talking about and the arguments made have not evolved with time.
There's, in a sense, different sets of trends happening, and they go in somewhat different directions. I think you can make an argument, for example, the argument we would make is that there was a very powerful moral case for the creation of the State of Israel and for Israel's existence today based on centuries of anti-Semitism and, of course, culminating in the tragedy of the Holocaust. And so there was enormous sympathy at the time of Israel's creation and lots of sort of good feeling in the United States. And over time, that image has eroded. Most powerfully due to the implications of the occupation, the post-67 occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, and then the subsequent treatment of the Palestinians over now many decades, which has eroded Israel's image around the world, and even to some degree in the United States, and to some degree among Jewish Americans as well. So that's one trend. Second trend, of course, is Israel's strategic value, which you could argue actually went up for a while as it grew more capable, and in the context of the Cold War was something of an asset. But once the Cold War came to an end, its value as a strategic asset begins to decline, and it becomes, of course, a problem for the United States, particularly in generating anti-Americanism in the Arab and Islamic world. And the third trend is that key groups in the lobby become more powerful, more influential over time. AIPAC was a rather small operation in the 1950s, you know, a small office, one lobbyist up on Capitol Hill.
I'm sorry,
the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. It's widely regarded as one of the most important elements in the Israel
probably
lobby.
Probably the most powerful.
It's essentially a one-man show, almost a one-man show in the 50s and 60s. And by now, in 2007, an annual budget of about $50 million, a very large, well-paid staff, regional offices around the country, a great capacity to help shape campaign contributions for candidates. It's just an entirely different operation than it was. The summation of all these trends are, is in a sense, although the moral case for giving Israel unconditional support has gone down, and the moral or the strategic case for giving Israel unconditional support has gone down, the power of the lobby has gone up, and American support for Israel continues to go up, despite the fact that, again, the strategic and moral case for this level of support and its unconditional nature has been reduced.
It's much more difficult for a president today to put pressure on Israel than it was in 1990 or 1980 or 1970. All the way back to
1956, when Dwight D. Eisenhower really put pressure on Israel to get out of the Sinai after the 56 war. It's hard to imagine an American president being able to put that kind of pressure. He basically threatened to cut off all U.S. economic aid if they didn't.
At the time of the Suez War.
1956.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Right. And again, it's hard to imagine an American president doing that now.
Mm-hmm. So help me and the audience understand what we're talking about when we're talking about the Israel lobby, because in this discourse one has trouble because of the history of anti-Semitism, but you're pretty careful in your wording, and I want to go over that. What is the lobby?
Well, our argument is, Harry, that the lobby is a loose coalition of individuals and groups who work actively to push American foreign policy in a pro-Israel direction. Now, we're not arguing that they're pushing American foreign policy in a direction that favors Israel and does damage to the United States. Mm-hmm. We believe that the policies that they're advocating, the individuals and groups in the lobby, are ones that they believe are good for the United States and good for Israel. We disagree with that on both counts, but that's what they believe. Mm-hmm. Many of our critics have said that we're talking about a cabal or a conspiracy. We go to significant lengths in the piece and in all our public presentations to make it clear that we're talking about no such thing. This is an American interest group. It's like the National Rifle Association. It's like the Farm Lobby. It's like the Cuban Lobby. It's just another interest group that is operating in ways that are, as Steve said before, for the most part, as American as apple pie. Another point that needs to be emphasized here is that we're not talking about a Jewish lobby. A number of our critics like to use the phrase Jewish lobby, when in fact we say explicitly that this is not a Jewish lobby, it's the Israel lobby. Now, why is that the case? First of all, not all Jews could possibly be included as part of the lobby, because if you look at the basic makeup of the American Jewish community, it's quite clear that about a third of American Jews do not feel any significant attachment to Israel. It's just not something that matters that much to them. So in no way could you include them in the lobby. So not all Jews are in the lobby. Furthermore, it is quite clear that inside the lobby are a number of important constituencies that are not Jewish, the most important of which are the Christian Zionists. But also, a number of key neoconservatives like John Bolton and Jim Woolsey, who we would include in the lobby, are not Jewish. So this is not a Jewish lobby. It's the Israel lobby. It is defined not by ethnicity or religion. It is defined by its political agenda. And its political agenda, again, just to be perfectly clear, is to push U.S. foreign policy in ways that benefit Israel and at the same time are believed to benefit the United States.
Yeah, I would just add a couple of points to what John said. Obviously, it's a heterogeneous coalition to some degree. There are differences between different groups and individuals in it. So some organizations, for example, the Zionist Organization of America, a very hard-line group that believes Israel should basically control all of the occupied territories in perpetuity. And many of the Christian Zionists, if not all Christian Zionists, these hard-line Christian evangelicals, also favor that. There are other groups that also want the United States to have a special relationship with Israel, want American foreign policy to be very pro-Israel, who nonetheless favor a two-state settlement, think that Palestinians should have a state of their own, think the United States should push for that, although they tend not to think the United States should ever really squeeze Israel hard on that. But nonetheless, that's the outcome they would like to see. So it's not a single unified organization with a leadership that, you know, sort of hands out orders to the rank and file. It's a loose coalition.
And I believe you're suggesting when you're describing the lobby that in this period when there's been a historical evolution since, say, the 67 war to the present, the balance of power within what we can call the faction that is the supporters of Israel, to use Madison's term, namely faction, that the balance of power within those groups has shifted, and so you get an output that may not be universally agreed on, which is what you were just suggesting.
If you looked at the spectrum of organizations within it, the most powerful and influential, the ones with the largest budgets, tend to have the most influence on the policy process, tend to be on the hardline end of the spectrum, and they've moved in a more conservative direction or more hardline direction over time. There are a number of other organizations, Americans for Peace Now, Brit Tzedek V'Shalom, the Israel Policy Forum, that are on the more moderate, even dovish side of the spectrum. And they're, we actually would agree with many of the policies they favor, but they're not as influential, not as powerful, not as wealthy in their capacity to shape events.
In the course of this evolution, during the Cold War, or the latter part of the Cold War especially, Israel, the strategic rationale for the support of Israel was an asset in the region as we competed with the Soviet Union for influence and power. With the end of the Cold War, that rationale no longer existed. So what replaced it, and how has that played into our current dilemma?
Well, the rationale that the lobby put forward after the Cold War ended was that the Soviet threat was replaced by the terrorist threat, and that the terrorism threat that Israel and the United States faced was essentially the same threat. So we were, in effect, partners in a war against terrorism. That was the argument that the lobby made in the 1990s, but certainly after 9/11. And our basic argument is that that's wrong, and that one of the principal reasons, and Harry, I want to underline the word one here, one of the principal reasons, not the only reason that we have a terrorism problem today, is because of our unconditional support for Israel, especially with regard to its policies, Israel's policies towards the Palestinians and the occupied territory. So we disagree with that new rationale that the lobby has adduced.
And I guess if you're fighting a war on terrorism, then you are looking for a global mission in a way, and you're saying that one terrorist group is just like another, which would seem to raise problems for the United States if it wants to behave responsibly globally and actually deal with the problem.
Obviously, John and I are no defenders of terrorists of any kind,
right.
But one of the mistakes the United States made, and it's not a mistake, I think it's unique to the U.S.-Israeli relationship, was in the aftermath of September 11th to basically declare that the enemy here was terrorism with a capital T. And as you just indicated, that implies that all terrorist groups are fundamentally identical. The fact is that terrorism is not a single movement or a single organization. It's just a tactic that many different groups of many different political stripes have used throughout history. And some terrorist organizations in the past, in fact, got help from the United States because we favored their objectives. And of course, many people have pointed out, the original Zionist mission included Zionist terrorists who used traditional terrorist methods against the British when they were trying to carve out their own state in Palestine.
Two of whom became prime minister.
Two of whom ultimately became prime minister. So again, terrorism is not the enemy. There may be states, movements, groups whose objectives are hostile to ours and who try to attack the United States and obviously are a problem for us. But it was a mistake that we made to try and view this all as one single undifferentiated problem. Now, of course, many Israeli leaders and key organizations in the lobby liked that because they could say, look, we have a terrorism problem, you have a terrorism problem, it's the same problem. But of course it's not, right? Some of the organizations that Israel has a problem with don't attack the United States, don't try to attack the United States. And that raises then the question of what's the best way of dealing with each individual terrorist organization through some combination of, you know, offensive action, but also attempting to try and find political solutions that would make them less influential, less powerful, or might in some cases cause them to put down their arms and abandon those tactics the same way that the original Zionists did once they got their own state.
I sometimes think that we use labels. We say Israel, but we're in a way talking about factions within Israel. We say the United States, but we're talking about a faction in the national security bureaucracy and so on. And it seems that we get alliances across international boundaries in this age of globalization, which then creates labels that don't actually help us understand the problem.
I think that's sometimes the case, but what do you have in mind in particular here?
Well, I think you cite, for example, cases where former heads of security apparatus in Israel have criticized the policies of Israel toward the occupation. In the United States, it's not clear that if, had there been a different administration after 9/11, if the neoconservatives hadn't been so influential, then our policies might have taken an entirely different course.
Yeah.
And so in this moment in time, you get agreement across boundaries, and you get a powerful output that appears to be much broader than it may in fact be.
Yeah. Just two quick points on this. One is, I do believe, we can never be certain, but I do believe that if Al Gore had been elected president in 2000, that in the wake of 9/11,
he was elected president.
Yes,
that's correct.
That's a different program.
Yeah,
that's right.
But if he had been the president after 9/11, that we would not have attacked Iraq, because, as you know, Al Gore was an adamant opponent of the war in Iraq, as were Steve and I. But I believe that's correct, that we would not have attacked Iraq. So I agree with you there. But with regard to Israel itself, a good example to support your point is that there are a very large number of individuals inside the national security establishment in Israel who believe that Israel should cut a deal with Syria over the Golan Heights for the purpose of splitting Syria from Iran and getting Syria to help Israel deal with the the Hezbollah problem in Lebanon, and also just creating a peace agreement between Syria and Israel, much the way you have a peace agreement between Jordan and Israel, Egypt and Israel. Mm-hmm. So there are significant differences among Israeli elites on key policy issues. There's no question about that. And inside the United States, you have those differences too.
Yeah, I think Harry was actually raising an even more interesting question, which is almost a theoretical question of how you conceive about foreign policy, which is, to what extent does foreign policy get shaped by what one might call transnational coalitions? Mm-hmm. And there's a literature on this that isn't about the Middle East. It's just a more general literature. And I do think when two countries become very closely intertwined, as the United States has been with Israel, and it has been with a number of its NATO allies, the British being the most obvious one, you obviously get channels of influence that run both ways between people who are, you know, one step down in bureaucracies who are constantly working with each other and are going to try to influence each other's thinking in various ways and can even invoke each other to try and gain political support back home, back in the bureaucracy. And I think we see a number of instances in U.S.-Israeli relations, in Anglo-American relations, where that sort of thing happens. And, you know, one of the points we've underscored in trying to write the book is that there's lots of aspects of this relationship that are both interesting but also of great importance for both countries. The problem is that nobody wants to talk about them.
Yeah, and that is the great problem.
The real danger here is we'll end up doing lots of things, and lots of people will think, you know, this isn't so smart. We really shouldn't be doing this. But no one can bring it up out into the open and talk about it. And our basic view is, look, when countries start conducting foreign policy without being able to talk about it candidly, they're going to make mistakes every now and then, if not all the time, and not be able to correct those mistakes quickly enough. We think that's been a huge problem for the United States in its Middle East policy more generally. We also believe, of course, this has encouraged Israel to do a variety of things that were quite foolish as well, and that Israel would, in fact, be better off if we had a more open discussion in the United States mm-hmm. about American policy and American support for Israel.
And it should be emphasized that that open discussion does occur regularly in Israel. And if you read Haaretz on a daily basis in English, you see that very clearly.
Absolutely. And not just Haaretz, other newspapers and media outlets in Israel where there is a wide open debate and where you can say all sorts of things very similar to what we've said, and no one will condemn you, and certainly no one will accuse you of being an anti-Semite or anything like that. Mm-hmm. That happens all the time in Israel, but it doesn't happen very often mm-hmm. here in the United States.
If you were to look at the op-ed pages of all the major newspapers in the United States, you would find no equivalent to Akiva Elder, Gideon Levy, Amira Haas, and Bradley mm-hmm. Burstyn, just to pick four examples of individuals who write regularly for Haaretz. We mm-hmm. just don't have an open discourse on the editorial pages and the op-ed pages of our major newspapers about Israel, mm-hmm. About its policies, and about the U.S.-Israeli relationship. In the end, the end result of this, I believe, is that we do significant damage to U.S. interests and to Israeli interests.
In your book, when you and we'll talk a little more about the Israeli-U.S. relationship with regard to the benefits that Israel gets from the relationship, but you talk a great deal about recent relations that should be important for us in the Middle East. Iran, Syria, the Lebanon 2007 war.
206.
Sorry, right. 206, yeah. Cases in which, for you and for your analysis and maybe for a broader international relations community, our policy, the way we're pursuing our national interests with regard to these countries, does not make a lot of sense. So talk a little about that, because, for example, in the case of Iran, there were initiatives that the Iranians were willing to make at the time of the Iraq war that we did not respond to.
Yeah. I'll say a few words about Iran, and Steve can say a few words yeah. about Lebanon, because those are two very prominent cases mm-hmm. in the book, and we've already talked a little bit about Syria. It's quite clear that starting in the early 1990s, the Israelis came to believe that the greatest strategic threat that was facing them, either at the moment or on the horizon, was Iran. And they began putting pressure on the United States in the early 1990s to pursue a confrontational policy towards Iran. And Bill Clinton went along with this, and George Bush has gone along with this. Nevertheless, at the same time, the Iranians were looking for opportunities over the course of the 1990s and in the early part of this decade to change this confrontational relationship they had with the United States and try and work out some sort of modus vivendi. It wasn't like they wanted to become kissing cousins with the United States or anything like that, but it is clear that they thought that this confrontational relationship was counterproductive for Iranian interests. But every time that the Iranians tried to improve relations with the United States, the lobby moved in and made it almost impossible for the president, be he Bill Clinton or George Bush, to do anything serious to improve those relations. In the wake of 9/11, the Iranians made it clear to us that they wanted to help us deal with our problem in Afghanistan. They wanted to improve relations. And during the course of these discussions, there was even evidence that they were willing to recognize the state of Israel and have decent relations with Israel if some sort of agreement could have been worked out between the Palestinians and the Israelis. So there's no evidence that the Iranians are hopelessly committed to opposing the existence of Israel forever. But anyway, we were unable, in large part because of the lobby, to reach any kind of accommodation with the Iranians. And the most important result of that is that we believe that it has made it extremely difficult, if not impossible, for the United States to shut down or limit Iran's nuclear ambitions. There's no question about it that this is a hard nut to crack no matter how you approach it. Mm-hmm. But our argument is that if you had a more cooperative policy, you placed more emphasis on diplomacy and on improving relations and removing the American threat and removing the Israeli threat, you're more likely to get a solution. But again, the Israelis have pushed us hard and the lobbyists pushed us especially hard not to have good relations with Iran.
The only footnote I'd add to that, of course, is the other outcome that this our policy has led to is the election of a hardline president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and it's hard to see that as a good development for the United States or for Israel, given some of his very objectionable statements over time. Again, one of these unfortunate events. Let me turn that to Lebanon. It's clear that Israel had a problem with Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, which was hostile and was arming itself, getting missiles from various places and posing a growing threat. So we don't deny that they had a real thing to worry about. Plus the fact there were these cross-border provocations going both ways. But the question is, what was their response going to be? And they developed a response that they then implemented in the summer of 2006, which had two parts to it, trying to disarm Hezbollah by bombing it and then bombing civilian areas in Lebanon to punish the rest of Lebanese society so that the government in Lebanon would finally put the squeeze on Hezbollah. And this strategy was deeply misguided. Right? It was doomed to fail from the beginning. It was easy to anticipate that they weren't going to be able to accomplish their military objectives. And, of course, punishing the rest of Lebanon for what Hezbollah was doing actually just made Hezbollah more popular. The problem was that the United States, because of the impact of the Israel lobby, was not in a position to tell the Israelis this was a stupid policy that wasn't going to work. And secondly, once the war started and then it was clear that the strategy wasn't working, the American government wasn't able to put pressure on Israel to get a ceasefire quickly, a ceasefire that, by the way, would have saved Israeli lives because Hezbollah was launching rockets into northern Israel. Instead, the American government, both the Bush administration and Congress, swung overwhelmingly behind Israel, delayed a ceasefire, and anyone who tried to raise questions about this, anyone like Human Rights Watch or Amnesty International, that criticized Israel's disproportionate response, or a handful of congressmen who said that, you know, really they thought Israel was kind of going overboard and threatening the democratic government in Lebanon, anybody who said this was immediately slammed by key organizations in the lobby. The United States would have been a better friend to Israel if we had either pushed them to come up with a better response to Hezbollah or if we had shut the war down as quickly as possible. That's what a good ally would have done. But because of the impact of the lobby, the United States was unable to be a good friend to Israel in that particular case. And that, again, damaged our image in the region, but it also, as many Israelis recognize, was a strategic disaster for them.
Both of these cases bring to mind an argument that's made against you in your work, in the sense that what you're working with here is a reductionist notion of what is causing the behavior of the United States in both cases, that the Israel lobby is the tail that's wagging, you know, the dog and so on. So I think just in a general way, we should address that problem because we have American exceptionalism. We have, you know, ideas about transforming the Middle East. We have nationalists chauvinistic nationalists like Cheney, and Rumsfeld, who aren't part of the lobby. So how do you answer people who say, sure, the lobby may have been a factor, in both of these cases, but it really wasn't the key factor. It was an element in the equation. But look, we have a president. He's elected by the people. We have a Congress and so on. And so we have to take these factors into account, the ideas, the institutions, and the personality that are running the country.
Well, two quick points. One is that in most of these cases, we're not arguing that the lobby was the only factor. Okay. This is most apparent in the Iraq War. A lot of people seem to think that we're saying that the lobby alone or the lobby in Israel alone caused the Iraq War. Nothing could be further from the truth. Our argument is that the lobby and Israel were two major driving forces behind the war. By themselves, they could not have made the war happen. But we believe that in their absence, in other words, if the lobby in Israel had not been pushing for the war, we would not have had the war. So we stay away from monocausal arguments, even though we're often accused of this by our critics. But to get to the nitty-gritty of your question, Harry, I think that what you have to do is you have to take every case and you have to get in, side the case, and you have to look at what happened. And what we have to do is bring to bear evidence that shows that a particular president or a particular set of policymakers were pushing American policy in one direction, and it appeared to be headed in that direction, and then the lobby weighed in and pushed it back in the other direction. And if we can't provide evidence to support those kinds of arguments, then we're not going to carry the day. Mm-hmm. Just to give you one example of where I think this happens, we show, I think quite clearly, that in the spring of 2002, this is April 2002, shortly after Ariel Sharon had ordered the Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, to reoccupy Palestinian lands that had been given over to Arafat as a result of the Oslo peace process, President Bush told Sharon in no uncertain terms that he had to get out of those areas immediately. And Condi Rice repeated that message to Ariel Sharon. What we then show is that the lobby moved in and in effect humiliated George Bush, forced him to back off, and actually say at the White House shortly thereafter that Ariel Sharon was a man of peace. So I think that what we did in that case is we showed that it was really the lobby that had turned Bush around on this issue, and that Bush actually understood at the time that what the Israelis were doing as a result of Operation Defensive Shield was not good for the United States. But he couldn't act on that belief because of the power of the lobby.
Mm-hmm. I want to take his question in a slightly different direction. I mean, I think that that context does matter here. John referred to the Iraq War. The context post September 11th was clearly critical. The United States is in this very unusual position where we have enormous power in the world. We're militarily very confident. We've won a series of wars quite handily going back to the first Gulf War. So there was never any real doubt that if we wanted to oust Saddam Hussein, we could do it.
Vietnam is behind us.
Yeah, Vietnam is behind us. And it was just clear that the military task of toppling him was not beyond our capabilities. Running Iraq, of course, was a separate matter. But getting rid of Saddam, we all knew we could do. And third, we were very scared after September 11th. The whole Middle East seemed potentially dangerous. Something had to be done about this terrorist problem, weapons of mass destruction. You know, it was very easy to work the American people into a state of real fear. That's all strategic context that then allowed key individuals and key groups in the lobby to sell a particular approach to that problem that they would not have been able to sell in other circumstances. I would add one other point to this. The United States is an incredibly wealthy and powerful country. And one of the things I think you do learn from realism, right, is that the world is a competitive place. But when you're in very good shape, when you're very powerful, you have much greater latitude, much greater margin for action. And you can do a lot of things that may be kind of stupid. You may even pay a price for doing them, and you're still going to be okay. And you could make the argument that domestic politics matters more in the United States case precisely because we have such latitude. If we had the Cold War back, right, if we had a real great power adversary that we thought was really dangerous, we would have to be much more focused on not letting our national interests get diverted, not miscalculating. You'd probably have a somewhat more open discussion. In a funny way, we have the luxury of allowing special interest groups of all kinds to distort American policy precisely because the United States is so big and powerful. Right? It's still costly. It may still lead us into considerable problems. But it's, you know, something, one of the things I think realism would tell you is that the United States is precisely in the position where you got to be real careful because it's possible to miscalculate and think you can get away with it anyway.
So the other thing that realism tells you is that when you do pursue policies that are caused by domestic political interest groups, that you invariably get yourself into a lot of trouble.
You shouldn't say invariably. Almost always.
Almost always. Okay.
So you've given me the opportunity to have you put on simultaneously your domestic politics hat and your international politics hat, in the sense you're saying that in both realms there isn't a balancer, so that there's no one out there balancing America's global power, which would discipline us. And on the other hand, domestically, what I'm hearing you say is that what happens with interest group politics and foreign policy is there's really only one interest group voice, and it's not being balanced.
On this particular issue, that's right. It's not that there aren't countervailing forces within American domestic politics. There are Arab-American groups that try to lobby. You could argue there are peace groups, for example, that are sometimes very critical of what Israel has done or critical of unconditional support. But if you look at the balance of power internally between the various groups in the Israel lobby and what you might put as the countervailing forces, it's overwhelmingly on one side. Just to give you one, you know, sort of fact on this, between 1992 and 2005, pro-Israel political action committees gave about $55 million to candidates for office in American elections, congressional and presidential elections. Arab-American groups in that same period, 92 to 2005, gave 800,000, so 55 million versus 800,000. That's not the only fact you could point to, but it suggests what the balance of power is. It is often said, of course, well, what about the oil lobby and what about the Saudi lobby? These, on foreign policy issues, are just nowhere near as powerful. And we talk about this at some length in the book. Oil companies are very energetic. There is an oil lobby out there. They do a lot of work in Washington, but it's mostly on domestic politics, environmental regulations, tax policy, drilling rights, things like that. The bread and butter of what drives an oil company or an energy company. On foreign policy, they tend not to be very energetically engaged. And this is why the former legislative director of AIPAC, a man named Douglas Bloomfield, told BBC News in 2003, AIPAC has one great advantage. We really don't have any competition. That's probably overstating it just a little bit, but it captures the essence of the imbalance of power inside the United States.
You can't cover everything, but you identify, and I wanted to just mention this, how the lobby works and its impact is felt. And you say constraining what presidents are willing to contemplate, forcing them to take steps they might otherwise avoid, making it harder to sustain initiatives that the groups oppose, shaping perceptions so that key officials will willingly favor the policies that these interest groups are pushing. So this is phenomena common to all interest groups, and what you're saying, it's very powerful in the case of Middle East policy.
Well, let me explain basically how the lobby operates. It pursues two strategies. The first is to influence the policymaking process. And the second is to shape, to dominate the discourse about Israel in the United States in ways that make the Israelis look like the good guys, the Arabs look like the bad guys, and make Americans think that the wise policy is to support Israel unconditionally. But just to say a few words about the first strategy, which is to dominate or to influence the making of policy. You talked mainly about how the lobby influences the executive branch, the president and his advisors, and of course they do that very well. Where the lobby has its greatest influence is actually on Capitol Hill. The lobby is very effective at going up there and putting pressure on congressmen and congresswomen and senators to support policies that are pro-Israel. And if any of those legislators are running for re-election and the lobby believes, and here we're talking mainly about AIPAC, but if AIPAC believes that those legislators are not sufficiently pro-Israel, they'll do everything they can to help those legislators go down to defeat in the next election. And it'll help get people elected who are likely to be pro-Israel. So you see that inside the executive branch and inside Congress, they work hard, as other interest groups do, to influence outcomes. And then we get to the second broad strategy, which is controlling discourse. There are a lot of people in the media who are naturally sympathetic to Israel. Someone like William Safire, who wrote for the New York Times, didn't need any encouragement from AIPAC or the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations to be pro-Israel. He was naturally quite pro-Israel.
And by that you mean that's where his ideas about national interest were. You're not suggesting anything. Yeah.
He would see the interests of the two countries as essentially identical. Tended to favor rather hard-line Israeli policies and a very hard-edged American approach towards the Middle East.
But what the lobby does is it goes to considerable lengths to make sure that other op-ed columnists and editorial writers don't say things that are hostile to Israel or hostile to the U.S.-Israeli relationship. If somebody writes an editorial that's deeply critical of Israel, if it was the Los Angeles Times or the New York Times, you can rest assured that a bevy of organizations like CAMRA would write letters and generate email and letter-writing campaigns and so forth and so on. Telephone calls would come. And furthermore, the lobby goes to considerable lengths to try and influence the discourse on university campuses. After 2002, when there was a bevy of criticisms against Israel on campuses, they went to great lengths to what they call take back the campuses. So basically what the lobby does is try to influence the policymaking process as much as possible and to create a situation where the discourse is as pro-Israel as possible. And they do a very good job at it.
And as you've said, though, this is as American as apple pie insofar as its interest group behavior.
That's right. When you talk about, say, media coverage in the United States, many people think, given bizarre conspiracy theories like the protocols of the Elders of Zion, that we're saying something like, there's Jewish control of the media, which we're not saying at all. In fact, groups like CAMRA exist, the Committee for Accuracy on Middle East Reporting in America. It's a watchdog organization. They exist to put pressure on media organizations precisely because there isn't any kind of control. You have to lean on people. Just last month, CNN broadcast a documentary that compared Christian, Muslim, and Jewish fundamentalism. Christiana Amanpour was the anchor. And it three separate episodes, one on Jewish fundamentalists, Christian fundamentalists, and then one on Muslim fundamentalists. And immediately in the aftermath, a number of prominent organizations in the lobby, including the Conference of Presidents, began organizing protests directed at CNN, and in particular, asking people to write companies that had bought advertising time and to complain to the advertisers. Now, if you're CNN, this is something you have to take very seriously. And the purpose, of course, is to make sure that the next time you think about doing a show like this, you'll think, well, maybe we ought to make sure it's a little bit more favorable because we don't want to get that avalanche of mail and those other protests. And that's only one of many other examples where radio stations and newspapers have faced boycotts and other forms of pressure from well-organized groups who want to make sure that their coverage is as favorable to Israel as possible. Now, I should add one other point. They're not the only group that does this kind of thing. You would find the same thing in other politically hot topics as well. What we always keep coming back to is that this is ultimately not the way we're supposed to do business in the United States. We're supposed to have open discussion of issues. And by failing to allow open discussion of these issues, we end up with policies that aren't in America's interest. But we also believe that we've ended up with policies that have ultimately been very harmful to Israel. To take the most obvious example, many Israelis and many Jewish Americans understand that the entire settlement enterprise was a real strategic and moral disaster for Israel. And American presidents have always opposed it, but they've never been able to put any pressure on it because the political cost of trying to do it would be too great. And that's in part because we can't even talk about that very openly here in the United States.
So what is our national interest in the Middle East that we're not dealing with adequately?
Well, we have three major interests in the Middle East. One is to ensure that the flow of oil out of that area of the world continues unabated. Second, to prevent nuclear proliferation in the region. And we're especially worried about the possibility that some terrorist organization like Al-Qaeda might get its hands on nuclear weapons. And third, we're concerned with defeating the terrorist threat that is directed against the United States and, if possible, dealing with other terrorist threats as well. We believe that with regard to the proliferation problem and with regard to the terrorism problem, for sure, that our policy of giving Israel unconditional aid has made it more difficult to deal with those problems. The best case, of course, is the terrorism problem. There is little doubt that America's unconditional support for Israel's policies towards the Palestinians, its brutal treatment of the Palestinians, and its colonization of the West Bank, enrages huge numbers of people in the Arab and Islamic world, causes some of them to become terrorists, serves as an ideal recruiting device for terrorist organizations, and provides support for the Osama bin Ladens of the world. And the end result of this is the United States has a major league terrorism problem. And it's not driven, that terrorism problem is not driven simply by American support for Israel's policies towards the Palestinians, but it is driven in good part by that. And that just is one example of how a particular American national interest, which is to stop the terrorist threat against us, is hindered by our relationship with Israel.
So what is the answer to opening the debate, the dialogue in the United States? Obviously, the lobby is a legitimate faction in Madison's sense.
Absolutely.
So how do we proceed, in the case of a group that has done a very good job of following what our system is about?
Well, our contribution to this is to write a book that, among other things, write a book to try and open this up. And one of the themes that we strike in the conclusion of the book is to hope that many people in the United States who feel an attachment to Israel and a commitment to it in some way will think more and start talking more openly among themselves. As John said a while back, if the key organizations in the lobby were pushing a different set of policies, we would have no objection, mm-hmm. and we think that would be much better for Israel as well. Our basic view on the U.S.-Israeli relationship, of course, is that the United States should be treating Israel like a normal country. Right, that we should treat it the way we treat other democracies. We should back them when they do things that we think are good, and we should oppose them and be willing to withdraw support if they're doing things that we don't think are in our interest. We should, again, treat it like a normal country. We're not talking for abandoning Israel or anything like that. We're talking about, again, treating it as a country that's a successful, normal democracy. And the only way to have that begin to be American policy, we believe, is for all Americans to start talking about this more openly and for people not to treat this as a taboo that you can't bring up and have a policy debate the same way we would debate our policy towards Japan, our relationship with China, what we're doing in Latin America or any other part of the world.
I was just going to say one key point, Harry, and we've touched on this before, but it can't be emphasized enough, is that states make mistakes. States, whether you're talking about the United States or Israel or Britain, Germany, you pick your country, those states occasionally pursue foolish policies.
They're not omniscient.
They're not omniscient. And therefore, it's very good to have open and freewheeling debates where critics are allowed to take out after the policy of the day, because it may avoid a disaster, number one. Or number two, if you get into a disaster situation, it may help you figure out a smart way to get out of it. But open debate is a good thing. Mm-hmm. But what we have in the case of U.S.-Israeli the U.S.-Israeli relationship is a situation where it is very difficult to have a meaningful debate without those people who criticize Israel and the United States for its support for certain Israeli policies being called anti-Semites.
Which is, by the way, why you see the presidential candidates in the current election having such a lively debate on U.S. policy towards Israel. The largest recipient of American foreign aid, $500 per Israeli per year, and yet there's no discussion, even though all of them recognize that American Middle East policy has gone badly off the rails. They all kind of agree on that, and they have different prescriptions. But the one item that, of course, is never questioned is the special relationship. And that suggests that there's something getting in the way of an open discussion. Given all the other things the presidential candidates disagree on, it is kind of surprising that they don't ever disagree on that.
We just have a few minutes left. One last question. Brief answers. You're tenured at Chicago. You're tenured at Harvard. What have you learned about evidence and public discourse and civilized discourse as a result of this exercise?
Well, this is a debate that's taken place very much in the public realm, not in the academic realm. Steve and I have each written 3 books. Before we wrote this book, and the debates surrounding those books largely took part in the academic realm. And in that realm, not always, but most of the time, the debate involved evidence and logic. Mm-hmm. This debate is one where we believe evidence and logic usually doesn't come into play. And what we have discovered is that our opponents, so to speak, our critics, use basically 3 tactics to go after us. Number one, they smear us, and you see very little of that in the academic world. 2, they constantly misrepresent our arguments. It is truly amazing how often people accuse us of saying X when we said the opposite of X. And number 3, we're frequently accused of doing shoddy scholarship, which, interestingly, is a charge we were never accused of before we wrote this book. We consider these 3 charges basically to be, this word may be a little bit strong, but it captures the essence, I think, of what we think. These charges are bogus charges. Really, they don't carry much weight. But nevertheless, they're leveled at us all the time, and we're forced to constantly deal with them instead of being in a position where we can deal with the substance of the book.
I'd say just a couple of things quickly. First of all, this whole issue is sometimes discussed as a sort of Jewish versus non-Jewish issue. One of the things that I've learned about this, of course, that's the wrong way to think about it, because, of course, you have Jewish Americans and non-Jewish Americans on all sides of this issue. That's one thing that's become clear. The second thing is, leaving aside some of our more prominent critics, who are often, unfortunately, rather visible in mainstream media circles, but leaving aside that, I've been struck by how the vast majority of people that I deal with, not everyone, but the vast majority, welcome this discussion. Even the people who may have some disagreements with some of what we've written think it actually is something that ought to get out there and ought to get talked about. I think our correspondence is, you know, sort of 80% favorable, some of it very, very favorable. So I've actually been struck by how I think most Americans, and by the way, public opinion polls would bear this out, most Americans don't want the United States to give any country, including Israel, unconditional support, and they welcome an open and civil debate on this and many other topics. And again, we hope that that's the ultimate outcome of the book.
On that note, I want to thank you both for taking the time. We could have gone on for several hours, but the program is 1 hour. And let me show your book again, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. And I want to thank John and Steve for coming back to our program and telling us about their book.
Thank you for having us, Harry.
Lots of fun to talk to you.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.